life is ours, we live it our way. Hold these words, I don't just say, and nothing else matters. Trust I seek, and I find in you. Every day for us, something new. Open my
Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio, audio medicine from Green Zone Hero. We're proudly American, unapologetically patriotic, and politically incorrect. We are the voice, the platform for transitioning veterans, honoring their stories and wisdom. Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio. I'm John Krotek, U.S. Army veteran.
I'm Chris Hager, Gold Star Father.
We have a very special guest today. It's our first across-the-pond guest from the U.K., Sergeant Simon Harmer, who served, actually as a combat veteran, who served in the Royal Army Medical Corps for 16 years. And during that time, Simon, he likes to go by Si, I know he does, he'll tell you more about that. During that time, those 16 years, he deployed to Bosnia, Iraq, and the Congo. Rather interesting. 2009, things took a turn in Afghanistan where Simon lost both of his legs in an IED blast. Needless to say, Simon has an incredible, very motivating story to tell us, and we are so excited and happy to have him here and very honored to have our first United Kingdom Royal Army combat veteran. Good morning, Si.
Morning. How are you?
Doing great. Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
God save the Queen and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I'm not stood to attention.
Love you, man. So
both my heels are together, but just not in this country.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I have to interrupt. I have a direct question. I don't get to talk to too many Brits. Do you have to use the right side of your brain when you drive on the wrong side of the street, or you know, how does that work out mentally?
Well, you kind of need a brain to start with, I suppose.
Oh.
It's all very confusing, isn't it? It's all very confusing.
I'm just glad I've never had to do it.
You know,
the thing is, it's a nightmare when you go across our little bit of pond to Europe, and trying to work out which side of the road you're supposed to be driving on. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, kind of funny though, because you know I spent some time in the Virgin Islands, and you know we were driving on the left side of the road down there, and the only time it was ever a problem was when I had one or two beers too many. And then we revert back to the other side, and it's, you know, some harrowing experiences there, needless to say.
How do you actually get to one beer too many?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Sorry, I'm just...
You hang out with my friends, you'll find out.
Simon, it is an honor to speak with you, and I mean that from the depth.
Well, we're trying to do some things. We want to hear your story. What was it like growing up in England? Tell us about the Harmer household.
So I grew up in a place called Winchester, which is the ancient capital of England. So the first sort of major king of, I suppose, England, which is King Arthur, his great grandson was actually the first real king of England. So I don't live far from Stonehenge. I live about an hour away from London. It's all, everything's still quite... the architecture and a lot of the buildings are, you can see they're straight through the ages, from medieval times all the way to modern times. And every time I go to Winchester or go to London, you'll always see something different or something new, especially if you look up.
Is it hilly, or is it, what is it, woods or mountains, or what is it like there?
Undulating. So the hills, most of our hills or big peaks are in Wales or Scotland. We've got some sort of bigger hills or mountains up in the middle, in the Midlands, but down south it's hilly, but it's not mountainous.
I've done a fair amount of reading about the old, the Stonehenge times, and one of the things that was very interesting, they started to try and calculate how many people had to be alive in the middle of England when those things were going on, and it's like there were tens of thousands more inhabitants of the island than a lot of us would think of. You know, we think about in 1,000 years ago, there wouldn't have been that many people, but there were thousands on the island. It really is interesting stuff.
I think it's also quite transient as well, because there was a link between Stonehenge and another sort of monument, which I can't remember which one it is, but I think it's up in the Shetland Islands or somewhere like that, which is similar. And so I think there was lots of free travel from Europe to Stonehenge, you know, because there's lots of artifacts that have been found from sort of all over different parts of Europe and North Africa as well. So I think people used to travel here.
Yes. Yeah.
And even, you know, historically, everybody knows, you know, the kings, the queens, the Celts, the Saxons, you know, all of these different forces that were constantly going through the island. Even Hadrian's Wall, you know, the Roman Empire stretched way up into there. So,
yeah, truly, yeah.
Yeah, I really want to get over there someday, and I have some buddies that are down in Snowdonia that say you got to come over and do some hiking with us. Have you ever been down there?
Yeah, I have. I've done that. I've done a lot of training in the south of Wales. The British Army do a lot of training there because it's hard and cold, and there's a particular cattle grid that if you go over it, it starts raining. So even if it's sunny on the other side of the cattle grid, you know what a cattle grid is?
Oh, yeah.
So if you go across the cattle grid, it starts to rain, and that's just the way it is in Wales. And then North Wales is even more mountainous and snow. Although we don't use it for training, as in combat training, we do use it to, you know, as adventurous training. So it's somewhere where we go a lot and use all the facilities around there.
So how did you make it to the Army? Tell us about that. What was instilled in you, Simon, to want to be, you know, a UK Army guy?
It was funny because actually when I was at school, I wanted to become a fireman. And you didn't particularly need any qualifications to join, but what you needed was a mechanical comprehension. You needed to be fit, clearly, and you kind of need something else because it's quite a desirable job in the UK to be in the fire brigade. And so I figured that I'll join the army, and I figured that being a medic specifically made more sense than, you know, having a trade behind myself. And something that I thought would translate, and it would make my transition into the fire brigade a lot easier if I had a trade like that behind me. So a lot of my friends and actually people in the army, they didn't get what the medical corps was all about, particularly outside of combat. And so people kind of used to scratch their heads and wonder why I joined the medical corps in particular. But for me, it gave, you know, I've done a huge amount of stuff in because I joined the corps, and it opened a huge, you know, many doors for me over the years.
You know, what was, we call it basic training. You know, I was Army guy, you know, went in as a private. What do they call it there? Is it called basic training?
Yeah, basic training as well.
Well, what was that like when you got there?
Do you know what? It's funny because I was listening to one of your other podcasts and you asked the same question to on your first podcast. And actually, I remember all the good stuff. You don't tend to remember the bad stuff, do you? I'm sure there was bad stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I've got a vivid memory. So I've always found it difficult to sleep, you know, amongst other people, which sounds rather odd. So I used to wear my ear defense, your ear protection at night. So I had these great big sort of, great big things on my ears, which was really difficult to sleep with. But I used to sleep with these ear defenders on to get to sleep at night. Because at 4 o'clock in the morning, the chefs used to come in and they used to make them, you know, it was right next to my room. And if I didn't want to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I wanted to get as much sleep as I possibly could. So I remember all the good stuff in basic training. I left with best recruit, which I wasn't expecting to, but I managed to swing it. I must have done something right, I suppose.
That's awesome, man. So but did you stay in England when you got out and went to your advanced training for all your medical? Was that in England too?
Yeah, so my initial training was up in a place called Lichfield, which isn't far from Birmingham. And then I came back down south to the home of the parachute regiment, which is Aldershot. But our training was conducted just outside of Aldershot in a place called Ash Vale. And our training was about 9 or 10 months long. And it was quite in depth as well, because they wanted, you know, the medics, obviously, you know, we had to know our bread and butter. And one of the main things they wanted us to know was obviously trauma. but everyone forgets that most of the time, particularly outside of combat situations, you really need to know the base primary healthcare and preventative healthcare. And to make a really good medic, you need to really have a clear understanding of the basics as well, not just the trauma stuff.
I know that in the special forces here, that one of the sections that they do is they give them wounded animals, and they have to keep them alive for a certain amount of time or something like that. You all do that?
Yeah. So not everybody gets to do it because there's, it's something it doesn't fit well, I suppose, with the British psyche, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, we look after animals better than we do each other, I suppose. But there is the opportunity to go and do it, and I know that they do it in Sweden. Some of our guys, they went over to South Africa to do it, and I think there was somewhere else in Europe you could go and try in get involved in that kind of stuff as well. But I know that it was invaluable training.
So you got out of training, you went through this extensive training, and you're in the medical corps. You have these dreams of being a fireman, and you're well on your way. What was your first deployment like?
So for the first 3 years of my military career, I was out of the country for about 3 years constantly because I did the opposite of what they told you to do. So in the army, they say don't volunteer for anything. So I thought, right, I'm just going to volunteer for everything. Because
I like you already.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's cool.
So I knew at the end of it, there was usually a reward, the carrot and the stick. And I knew that at the end of volunteering for something, generally speaking, there was some benefit of doing that. And that's kind of why, I was careful in what I volunteered for, but I pretty much volunteered for everything. And so, I went to Cyprus for some training for when I joined my first unit. Then we deployed over to Bosnia after doing, a huge training package, which involved exercising, training exercises, sort of theory, continuation of our medical training. So it was a big package. And we went over to Bosnia for the winter tour. I just remember being over there and we were on a two can rule. However, they never really used to count which can you're on. It ended up being like, the two barrel rule instead. Cause, I don't think anybody stuck to the toucan rule in Bosnia, including the Americans, because we were at a place called Banja Luka, and we were there with American troops as well.
Yeah, it always seems like nothing ever ends up the way they tell you it is.
Absolutely.
It's like, be ready for anything, anytime, anywhere.
Actually, there's a funny and amusing story. So our little med center was across the way from like this little special forces debt that they had out there. And they used to come in and out. We didn't never used to see them. I remember one day I went up to the toilets, which they're all outside toilets that they'd constructed, for us all to use. So I went into this little Corrimec building, and I just heard a voice from this toilet, and he said, "Oi, mate, can you get me out of this toilet?" So I got my Leatherman out, twisted the lock, and opened the door, and there was this massive, great big, hairy guy from the SAS stood there. Massive, great big handlebar moustache, which they're kind of renowned for. And he just looked at me, and he was a sergeant major. And he just looked at me and said, "Don't tell anybody." He locked in this toilet and he couldn't get out. And so, clearly I told everybody.
What was he doing in there, man? How did he get in there?
Well, he went in there, locked it, and for whatever reason, he couldn't get out of it. It locked itself, and I suppose he just didn't want to smash up this toilet, so he had to wait for the next person to come in to get him out.
That's hilarious, man. So what happened, man? So did you put his mug shot up?
Yeah, I let everybody know that he'd got stuck in this toilet.
Get locked in the loo.
Yeah.
That's funny. Is there a because of the incredible stories? My dad was a glider pilot in World War II, and he spent a fair amount of time in England prepping for the invasion. But we have the movie Dunkirk and all that. Do you carry proudly the tradition of heroism that the World War II Brits had? I mean, is that a part of almost daily life? Because my son was a Ranger. Rangers live and breathe the history of being Rangers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the Colt. Well, the Coldstream Guards. That you were a Coldstream Guard.
No. So I was attached to them.
Yeah.
So when I got out to Afghanistan and medics, we fly all over the place. You know, we get posted here. But I mean, you know, I've been attached to that many units. I've forgotten how many I've been with. Everything from the Scots Dragoon Guards in Canada, because I don't know if you know this, but the British Army got a huge training area that we use, a place called Battis, which is up in Suffield in Alberta, and it's basically an area for us to do tank manoeuvres on. It's an open prairie. You know, that's one of the places actually I went to initially when I first joined the Army. You know, I've been attached to all sorts of units all over the place, and I was only attached to the Coldstream Guards for probably 10 days. And initially, when I got out to Afghanistan, I was with the Light Dragoon Battle Group, which, you know, they're another tank unit, but they're a reconnaissance unit which use smaller tanks. And their background is quite interesting, actually, and they're an awesome bunch to be with. However, I was only actually with three Light Dragoons because, you know, we'd been... Throughout that 2009 period, the units that were part of that battle group had been battered, and you know, a lot of guys have been injured, killed, and there's a lot of battlefield casualty replacements. So actually, on the ground initially, I was with an infantry unit called the Mercian unit, and the Welsh Guards. So even though I was with the Light Dragoon Battle Group, I was also augmented to the two other units as well. I hope that makes sense.
Well, those are all very storied units. Like Chris was, you know, World War II. Those are units that have been around for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're talking Cromwell times. You know, the oldest regiment in the British Army is the Grenadier Guards, and they came back from France after his exile, and they were the first unit that was raised as by the king after Cromwell got defeated. And then the second unit to be raised was the Coldstream Guards. So even though they've been in existence for longer, the Grenadier Guards swore allegiance to the king earlier.
So those units, those storied units like that, you know, the esprit de corps must be pretty high.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking back to Napoleonic times and before. You know, there's a lot of history in all these units, and I mean, some of them have been amalgamated and some of them have been disbanded, but the remaining ones, you know, they take with them a massive legacy involving thousands of people.
I think there was a Chris can probably confer on this. Wasn't there a saying that the sun never set on the British Empire?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely. At one point, yeah, it did. You're absolutely right. Well, you know, all the way from Australia, you know, through Asia, all the way to Africa, we just didn't make it that well in North America.
Well, you guys tried.
You just didn't like our tea.
No, I'm not sure we were throwing it overboard or something like that. I'm actually reading a very interesting book on Thomas Jefferson, you know, after the Revolution, you know, with the British, and actually had emissaries over in London, and they were trying to work it out. So, you know, and it ended up good. We've been partners and friends. Of course, our lineage goes way back, but I mean, I think we've been together on just about everything since.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, apart from Vietnam. But I think, you know, we probably had some special forces out there, as I think that we did anyway. I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, I think the only thing that we haven't been involved in collectively is probably Vietnam.
Yeah, so, you know, in the Congo, you're the first person I've ever met that ever served in the military from the Congo. Was that a humanitarian mission there? What was going on there?
It was post me being in Iraq. You know, I went over there for the invasion, came back, got the dust off my boots, and then deployed straight back out the door to the Congo. And it was very political. It was very politicized. It was Jack Chirac and Tony Blair kissing and making up about, you know, the Iraq war. And it was the first European-led mission, actually, that was sort of, you know, that was completed, I suppose. We flew out there in a real roundabout way. It took us 4 days to fly out there on a fixed wing propeller driven Hercules. Yeah, it was an odd one. There was lots of kind of ethnic cleansing going on in the Congo. We were over there delivering some humanitarian sort of aid to them. There was a massive hodgepodge of different units. I remember we used to go past one camp. And I mean, they must have been really, really good soldiers. There were some from South America somewhere, because their vehicles were really, really shiny and clean. I don't know if they ever used them.
I hear you.
They must have been good.
Yeah.
Anyway, we never saw them leave their camp. We got attacked every Friday and Saturday. And it was quite funny, because initially we took it quite seriously and jumped into these pre-prepared sort of shell scrapes that we had that were sort of 6 foot deep. And then we realized that they couldn't hit a barn door from 5 meters away. So we ended up taking our time. You know, eventually we thought it would just be safer just to sit on our webbing rather than bother ourselves to get into these trenches.
You could have run into a bullet better than they could have hit you with one, is what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it got boring in the end because they couldn't hit anything. So, you know, it was interesting. I hope we did a little bit of good out there, but it was an odd one. It was an odd one to be in.
Well, tell us about Afghanistan.
So there's a big gap between me and deploying. So I was a recruit training instructor for a while. I also supported our reserve effort as well for a while in down in South Wales. And then eventually I got back into the operational mix, and we deployed out to Afghanistan. I got married on the 1st of August in 2009. And then 2 months later, I found myself in Afghanistan after, you know, quite a long period of pre-training before we went out there. But my job actually initially was to stay in Camp Bastion in Helmand Province as a liaison, I suppose, and helping to decide what assets were needed on the ground to pick up casualties. And usually it was helicopter, but we used obviously the Chinook, which was the MERT variant, which is the medical emergency response team or reaction team. And we also had the Pedro, which was two Black Hawk American assets that we used as well. So initially that was my job out there, but when I landed, my job changed and they needed more medics on the ground because obviously the threat was so high out there. So I never saw the inside of my tent that I was supposed to go and work in. You know, I was just deployed straight onto the ground, really.
So pretty much boots on the ground right in all the stuff that was going on.
Yeah, and it was exciting. You know, I was only in theater for a month, a full calendar month, and I was on the ground for 26 days. And I'll be honest with you, I saw more trauma in 26 days than I had in my whole military career. And bearing in mind, you know, I'd done two tours to Bosnia, I'd been to the Iraq, I'd been to the Congo, I'd also, you know, done some time as a paramedic as part of my training. So it was a really, really kinetic time for us. You know, bullets being shot at us and bombs going off beneath us. It was a heavy time.
So, you know, confusing, needless to say. I mean, was it hard to know who the enemy was?
Yeah, and, you know, people kind of make assumptions about the Afghan people, and it wasn't always clear why they were doing something. And it was for reasons that were sometimes beyond us. And I didn't have it in me to kind of dislike them. I felt that they were probably stuck between a rock and a hard place, between being told to do something, being made to do something, being paid to do something, or, you know, their cultural belief of, you know, the blood vendetta kind of, you know, I had a different opinion, I suppose. I was a little bit more thoughtful about why things happened, and it wasn't just as clear cut as you first envisaged, I suppose.
Well, and one of the things I've said over the years about my son and young men and women he served with, you aren't there because you hate somebody. You're there essentially, you know, we were there because of how much we love our freedom and that, and you weren't there because you hated somebody. Now, that's not always true of the enemy. I mean, there's a lot of those people that just want to kill anybody in the West, but not the Afghans probably. But, you know, Taliban is there because they hate people for whatever reason.
Yeah, and a lot of them, you know, we used our interpreters really well, and they could pick up on the atmospherics of an area quite well as well, particularly if we were new in theatre, when we would get more tuned into it. But they would know if someone was from out of area, and they would know if someone was from, they were a local. So it kind of, it mattered I suppose, who you were dealing with at the time. It wasn't always clear cut where that person was from. When they were from out of areas, there was a different perception from them. And it was usually, I suppose it was hate. And if they were local, it was sometimes indifferent. It was just like, oh, there's another set of boots on the ground. You might be from a different country, but essentially you're just another person coming to our country. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
I had a friend once that, and connected back to the UK a little bit, and this goes like 25 years ago or so, but he had gone to Ireland, and one of his friends that was from Northern Ireland, just with a glance, you could tell somebody was either Protestant or Catholic by what they were wearing. And my American friend had couldn't see that. I got to think that in Afghanistan, the same thing goes on. You know, if you're an Afghan, you can look at somebody and know where they're supposed to be because there's some part of the garb that was
out of place.
Was tied to geography, and it would be almost impossible for a Westerner to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I try to view things slightly differently, and I wasn't naive, but I just try to do my job and not judge people on face value, just judge them on their actions, really, I suppose.
Yeah, probably a good thing most of the time. But things changed for you. They absolutely changed. Your life dramatically changed, and it obviously didn't slow you down. You've been involved in a huge recovery period, but also you've been involved in a lot of very active things, and you're trying to help others, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so the day I was hit, I don't know if you want to hear that story. You know, I was conscious throughout the event, and I remember it vividly. So if you want to, I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
No, go ahead. I just want to remind everybody that we're on Straight Outta Combat Radio, and our combat veteran guest today is Sergeant Simon Harmer from the Royal Army Medical Corps. Just thank everybody for listening in today.
So the day I was hit was the 26th of October 2009. I woke up really early in the morning, and we were going to leave probably around 4 o'clock in the morning to leave our patrol base. We were going to march or patrol to a preordained area to provide overwatch for a Chinook that was going to land, and then, you know, more troops were going to join us, and then we were going to go and clear some compounds. I remember, you know, getting myself ready. I didn't want to wake up the other bloke, so I kept my, you know, the light to a minimum. I got, you know, got my breakfast on, sorted myself out, got all my kit on, and then made my way to what we, you know, the front gate, or what we called the front gate anyway. And then we all formed up, and we were getting ready to leave, and we realized that our interpreter wasn't with us. Yeah, and he was in his sleeping bag, and probably thought that being in his sleeping bag was more important than going for a walk. You know, but he's an Afghan, and he's not going to get into too much trouble. I actually think that saved my life, that the fact that he was in his DOS bag or in his sleeping bag, you know, I think that saved my life, because it meant that we left a lot later. So it was coming up to sort of 5 o'clock in the morning before we left. So we patrolled out, probably got about 150 metres outside the patrol base, where an improvised explosive device was activated beneath me. And now I was the 10th man in a file of blokes. You know, I was launched into the air, I landed somewhere else, and I was initially knocked out. A few seconds later, after being knocked out, I came to. And actually, whilst I was lying there, sort of unconscious, I remember it was like being in the Millennium Falcon, where it goes into hyperdrive.
Yeah.
A couple of questions sort of came into my mind. And the first one was, am I hit? Is anybody else hit? And can I treat them? And then I woke up. And then I realized instantaneously that my life had completely changed. My right leg had been blown straight off. My left leg was degloved from my ankle to my knee. My pants and trousers had been blown off. My right testicle was gone, which was irritating because it was one of my favorites.
I'll loan you mine.
Yeah.
Yours are too small.
I've got three children now. Then my right arm had been dislocated and broken, and it was in a bit of a bad way as well. I couldn't really move because I was kind of like, I'd rolled onto my right side, and I couldn't push myself up. So I was kind of on my own, you know, and clearly I wasn't a priority at that time, because there was a brief firefight. they had to sort that little problem out first. They had to secure the area. They realized early on that someone had been hit, but they didn't know it was me, or they didn't realize it was the medic. When it was my turn to be sort of looked after, they couldn't get to me straight away, so they had to get the metal detectors out to clear a route to me. And then eventually they got to me and started to treat me. And they realized early on that they couldn't keep me there. They needed to get me out. So we used to use these sort of fabric stretchers. You know, it was a bit like a poncho, actually. And they threw me onto that. And then I was treated outside, you know, the patrol base. And they used, you know, sort of life-saving, cutting-edge techniques on me. I had needles drilled into my bones to give fluids and drugs. Obviously, they used tourniquets on me. They used the pressure dressings on me. And I'll just come back to that bit at the beginning. The reason why I think that us leaving slightly later saved my life is the Chinook was already in the air, and it was going off to pick up an Afghan national soldier that had been shot. My wounds were considered worse, so it was diverted to me, and they picked me up. Now the guys, the medics that initially treated me, they saved my life without a shadow of a doubt, and the guys in the Mert just continued that process. Our Chinooks, the variants that we used, the medical emergency response team, they were a mobile A&E department. They used plasma really early on. They used different type of drugs. So I know that the guys were given massive doses of antibiotics. We were also given ketamine, which was initially, it was actually designed to make you forget about what you'd experienced, but you know, I kind of remembered what had happened to me, so I probably wasn't given enough. I remember the flight back, which is only, it was 40 kilometers away from Camp Bastion, but it took us about 10 minutes because, as you guys probably know, the Chinook doesn't hang about. I remember getting off the flight and loaded onto an ambulance, and actually the guys that did that job in Afghanistan for us were the fire brigade. And I remember that dream of me joining the fire brigade was just a reminder that wasn't going to happen anymore. That was a done deal. It wasn't going to work. And it was kind of the end of that loop, I suppose. I remember making it into the emergency department. They continued to stabilize me and save my life. And it was an interesting sort of hour and a half. And, you know, people have asked me if it was painful, and it was extreme. You can't actually quantify how painful it was, and I don't really know how I managed to cope with it, to be honest with you. But I'm lucky that the support I had around me, you know, all the clinicians and the pilots and the guys that helped me, and you know, the fire brigade. You know, I'm just very fortunate that I'm still here.
You know, as I listen, Simon, I'm almost brought to tears because there's something in your voice that I don't hear. And that is any anger. You know, there's so many people that think they've gotten so screwed and it was like, compared to your losses, nothing. And I want to just tell you how much it means to my ears to hear somebody that understands and appreciates that people work to save your life. You're just a blessing.
Well, I also know that, you know, I was given 50 units of blood and that's 25 liters of fluid. And I know that was 50 blokes in Bastion that gave me their blood. So I can't really, I've got no room to be angry about anything, to be honest with you, because I think it would be disrespectful to the people that helped me.
Amazing story. Tell us about Selly Oak. So did you make it, so you came back straight away to England, obviously.
Yeah. So, you know, I was sedated and this all happened on the Monday morning. So I was sedated and flown back to on a CCAST, and I, for the life of me, I've never known what that stands for, but it's basically the RAF, but you know, they fly you back and they do it with a full medical team on board the flight. So all that period I was unconscious. I got back to the UK on the Tuesday, and I was having the second set of operations that week at about 11 o'clock in the morning. And they obviously needed to tidy up what had already been done and start their process of fixing me up, I suppose. And in that week, I had three operations, obviously the one on the Monday to stabilize me, my initial one in Selly Oak, and another one on the Wednesday. And this is one of the things, actually, they took from the guys that got injured in Afghanistan, that you can actually take more analgesia than people previously thought. And it's changed sort of medical treatment over the years because of what happened to us in Afghanistan, you know, the treatment that we received. That Friday, I was brought round. I remember actually waking up on the Thursday, and I had this nasal gastric tube that was in my nose feeding me, and I pulled it out. And I had this battle with my my dietitians.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me.
Because this thing really irritated me, and I didn't want it. I didn't want it. And I pulled it out, and whenever they used to, whenever I'd go back in for more surgery, it'd go back in. So I used to whinge about it and then pull it back out again. And then when I went back into for more surgery, it would be back in there. But it's one of the things that actually broke me. I didn't like having this thing, because I couldn't get comfortable with this tube that was up my nose at the back of my throat, obviously feeding me. And you know, it was one of the things that I found really uncomfortable, I suppose. I was quite blessed in hospital. You know, I saw a lot of people. In the first week that I was awake, I must have seen probably about, I don't know, the 50 to 100 people in that week. And by the Friday, I was exhausted because, you know, I was kind of saying the same thing to people and telling the same story. And I wasn't really getting an awful lot of time with my wife. And bearing in mind that by the time I was hit, we'd only been married for 57 days. And I just wanted to spend more time with my wife.
Well, I know she's certainly glad that you got back, and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of other people. And I know that your story is quite amazing. And like Chris says, you know, there's something in your voice that just is inspiring and motivating, just the tone and the way you tell your story. And certainly your kids are happy you're here. But I know, you know, you've been busy. You have not let this become an impediment for you. You've become pretty masterful with the Invictus Games. And I know you've got a charity, or you're supporting one or maybe two charities. You're a speaker now. You're skiing. You've got a bicycle. I mean, what's going on? Tell us, how did it change? And tell us what's happening now.
I'll be honest with you, nothing changed, because before I got injured, I did cross-country skiing. And I took it quite seriously. In the British Army, we did a lot of cross-country skiing, the Nordic skiing, so skiing up and down hills, and the shooting, which is actually one of the best sports I think you can do as a soldier, because it's, you know, you need to be able to shoot straight and accurately and be out, you know, be exerted at the same time. And in the summer, I used to put down, you know, my skis and pick up a bike and I'd take part in triathlon. So really, it wasn't anything that changed. It was a continuation of what I did beforehand. But clearly, I had to find different ways of doing stuff, and that's what I did. You know, I jumped on a hand bike and I did some stuff for Help for Heroes, and we cycled across northern France, and then a team of us actually did the race across America, a team of 8 of us. So we started in San Diego and cycled 12 states over to Annapolis in Maryland. Obviously, we crossed the Rockies and the Appalachian Mountains. You know, it was an amazing way to see America. I don't want to go to Kansas again, and I'm sorry if you're from Kansas.
I am.
He is from Kansas, Chris.
We had 50-mile-an-hour side winds that were never behind us, and I now know why Dorothy left. And it's just a very vivid experience for me, for being in. I found it beautiful. You know, there were straight roads, and it was an amazing way to see a country, and particularly a state. And it was just an interesting way to see stuff. And I'll never forget it. It was an awesome time. It's one of the best things I've ever done. You know, you guys were extremely, extremely welcoming to us. So 4 of us were on hand bikes, 4 of us on normal bikes. And we did 3,051 miles in 7 days, 7 hours and 38 minutes. Not that I was counting, but you know, that's what we did.
That's awesome. You know, there's a I love that story. There's a stereotype now of combat veterans, you know, and the media plays up on it quite a bit, that you all are crazy. And you know, maybe so, but to hear that story, it's obvious that you're not. And you know, what do you want people to know about combat veterans?
You know, I think you know, clearly, particularly ones that have been injured, We've got a lot to offer. You know, not just any veteran has got a lot to offer. And I think that there's some things that are missing from our transition into from military life into civilian life. And I think there's some stuff that we can do collectively together. And something I only realized recently was that I needed a mentor of some type and I didn't have one. And I think that whatever field you're going into, I think the guys that have already trod that path, whether they're a plumber, they're going into contracting, they're going into fitness, whatever it is that they're doing, I think that because you've trod that path, you should help the next man or woman behind you who's transiting from the armed forces, and you should be their mentor to tell them which courses to get onto, which courses not to get onto, and really best, you know, just to tell them, give them the knowledge that you've already got, whatever that knowledge is, to help them transition themselves. And I realized early on that I needed a mentor of some sort. It took me a long time to figure that out. I don't think that, and I don't know if you guys have got it right in the States, but that's one thing that's missing from us, I think, as veterans in the UK. As an injured veteran, I don't think I've got it in me to work full time anymore, and I don't want to work full time anymore. You know, I want to spend time with, you know, doing charitable challenges, whatever that looks like, whether it's cycling across America or skiing or swimming, and I do a lot of long distance swimming. I think that there has to be a way where we can dip in and out of paid employment, not just doing things for free, because there has to be a value attached to what we're doing. Otherwise, I think we get taken advantage of. And I'm guessing that it's the same sketch for a lot of the guys that have been injured in America.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
You know, they get asked to do stuff and it's usually for nothing. And I think that's wrong.
Yeah. You know, and I'm glad that you mentioned that's a very important point, Simon, because it's true. You know, we know wounded veterans that have voiced and said similar things, and that, you know, it's not appropriate. And surely a person should get rewarded, you know, monetarily or however they want to do it for their time.
Absolutely. You know, and if they don't need the money, that's fine. But then, you know, make a donation to a charity of their choice. But I just think that, you know, this injury affected me in many ways. And one of those ways was financially. And I can't put, you know, a thank you or a pat on the back doesn't put food on the table for my kids. And I think there's a long way to go for industry, both private and, you know, corporate, to get on board and support us, but not in a patronizing way. You know, you need to be rewarded for work you've done. I don't want a freebie, but I want to work.
You know, one of the things that annoys the heck out of me, and I'm not trying to be political on this at all, but our previous president had tried to make the case that businessmen, oh, you didn't build this, you know, it's like, oh, it's because the government did all of the infrastructure and stuff, somehow you didn't. And that's not the part that John and I are so passionate about. Freedom isn't free. We have the right to succeed and fail, and for freedom to do so, not only in the UK, but in the United States, because of the tip of the spear of those people like you willing to be in harm's way. And yes, you're the reason that freedom exists, because you paid the price personally. My son did with his life. That's the part that business should be recognizing a debt to. Not that the bridge exists, but that there are lives being in harm's way each and every day to protect the freedom to stay in commerce, to stay in business. And you're right on the money, sir.
That's, you know, that's the whole intent of our program. And I got to say, Simon, I'm glad we finally made contact by voice, and really appreciate you. I appreciate your wife. I appreciate your kids. I appreciate the United Kingdom. And like, as Chris says, you know, freedom is not free. And we so understand that. We want to educate. We want to help wherever we can. We're indebted to guys and ladies that have worn the uniform and have paid the ultimate price.
Well, you know, it's a privilege, you know, to be allowed on your show. I love America. I love visiting it. I've been a few times. I think I've done more states than the average American has.
Probably.
I've been to Vegas. I've been to I've done places like that. I've been to Montana, you know, I've done, you know, Colorado's a lovely place. Most tourists probably just see either the West Coast or the East Coast, but I've seen the middle parts, you know, and I think you guys are incredibly lucky to have such a vast area to go and explore. And, you know, it's a totally different place to the UK, but most Brits, they like traveling and they're always, you know, generally feel welcome in the States. So thank you very much for that.
Well, you're welcome. I can tell you, anytime you want to come to Florida, look me up. You got a place to stay, and the UK is on my bucket list. So I know, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you might have a vagabond U.S. Army soldier over there looking for you. So
you're more than welcome anytime. You know, we'd be you know, happy to look after you and show you the sights. And I think, you know, when people come, particularly from the States, I suppose, and sometimes they're completely sort of blown away by stuff in the UK and the history behind it. But, you know, it's everybody's history. It's not just ours.
It is a blessing, and I thank you so much for all that you've done and sacrificed, but for being with us and sharing your thoughts. It's just awesome, son.
Thank you very much indeed.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers. Have a good one.
Well, Chris, another great dose of audio medicine from Green Zone Hero. I mean, our first United Kingdom British Army medic, Sergeant Simon Harmer.
Again, can you imagine his voice? There was not a regret or a condemnation. I mean, that, I'm blown away. I am so in awe of his gentle spirit, and just, that's why he's healing.
Well, he, you know, Simon exemplifies the stiff upper British lip for
sure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, understatement there, but what I liked what he said at the end is he said, "I love America."
Yeah.
And so, just, you know, how mind-blowing is that?
Yeah.
So just happy to have him here, and we want to continue to thank guys and ladies like him who have served, paid the ultimate price. Of course, you having lost your son in combat, a Gold Star father. We're going to keep going. We want to thank everybody for joining us on Straight Outta Combat Radio. And I want everybody to stay tuned to our show. We've got a lot of great shows coming your way from around the world now with Simon breaking ground. We are proudly American, unapologetically patriotic, and politically incorrect. And I want everybody to remember
that freedom is not free. God bless you, John.
God bless you, Chris. Thank you.
So close, no matter how far. Matter.